Hello and welcome to Cinema Joes, where three average Joes discuss the significant topics in movie culture. I am your host, Alex Marcus, podcast editor for thepopbreak.com. Today is a very special episode of the pod, centered around a smorgasbord of musical releases from the past year. But before we get into all of that, let me introduce my wonderful co-hosts. Coming in all the way from Deutschland, please, finally, welcome back to the podcast, Noah France. How are you today, Noah?
Chocolate! I'm doing great. My throat's recovering.
Yeah.
I was worried for a while, listeners, that I might not be able to do the recording because my throat was turning me into chocolate granny from SpongeBob. But I recovered. Thankfully, I ate enough chocolate.
Yes, he's all better because I'm allergic to chocolate, so we couldn't do podcasts together otherwise. Anyway.
Because that's how allergies work over the internet.
Absolutely, everyone knows that. Also joining us fresh off the central New Jersey stage, it's Justin Mancini. Hello, Justin.
Hey, Alex, how you doing?
I'm doing excellent. I'm so excited to be doing this podcast with you guys because I've noticed over the course of the year that there is a shockingly, unusually high number of musicals this season. And I thought, what better way to say goodbye to 2021? And this won't probably be our final episode, but it is one of our final episodes of the year. So what better way to say goodbye to 2021 than to do a roundup of all of the best musicals out there. And so that's what we did. We considered a list of 10 films that have been released. We should note that there are two more musicals coming before the end of the year that have not been released yet. Those would be the highly anticipated by all of us, I can say with confidence, Sing 2, which comes out on Christmas Day.
Oh, yeah.
And also Joe Wright's Cyrano, starring Peter Dinklage, which is a musical movie that I am very curious about. I kind of can't believe it's real and not a joke, but people have seen it and say that it's good. So I'll be very curious to watch it.
The initial buzz has been quite positive. I'm very excited.
Yes, so we could not watch those. And unfortunately, there was a couple others that we also couldn't watch just because of scheduling. So we are going to be calling this episode the West Side Story Memorial Musical Awards because none of us, like apparently all of America, were able to watch West Side Story in the last week. But movies that we did consider for this list include In the Heights, Annette, The Amazon Cinderella, which I can't imagine is going to pop up on anyone's list, but we'll see. Everybody's Talking About Jamie, Dear Evan Hansen, Tick Tick Boom, and also two live recordings of musicals that were released on streamers this year, Apple TV Plus's Come From Away, and Netflix's Diana the Musical. So that's all of the movies, or quasi-movies, in the case of those last two.
They're the only movies from 2021.
Yes, exactly. At least as far as Noah's concerned, because he didn't get a chance to watch a lot of movies this year. But that's okay. There's always January to catch up. But speaking of movie musicals, we decided to talk about these movies by kind of giving some categories that we could kind of narrow down our favorite parts of these things, because like as we all know, every movie musical is like over 2 hours long because there's so much singing and there's dancing and there's feeling and there's emotions, so we kind of said, okay, well, what are the most interesting parts of a musical? Let's create categories around that. And the categories that we have are our favorite opening musical number, our favorite dance number, our favorite musical moment, our favorite romantic moment, because as we all know, the musical genre is a romantic genre at heart. And then, of course, favorite ensemble, favorite lead, and favorite supporting actor or actress. So that's all the categories that we're going to be diving into. And we have no time to delay. So without further ado, Justin, what was your favorite opening musical number of 2021?
Okay, so I'm actually going to go with the opening number from Annette, which will be probably the only time I talk about this film, because I was not a big fan, which was disappointing, especially considering how much I loved Carax's previous film to this. But I do really like the opening number in this. It is called So May We Start. It actually begins before the story proper in the film even begins. You get introduced to all the creative people, whether that's Karax himself, the director, who appears in the role of a producer at the beginning of this scene, as well as the Sparks, well, band, I guess, but the two brothers, Russell and Ron Mayall, who start singing. And then we get this very elaborate tracking shot that goes through the studio into the streets as all the people, including Adam Driver, Marion Cotillard, Simon Helberg, all end up joining this chorus and singing this really joyous introductory number.
So it's kind of like a reverse Goodfellas. We're not going into the restaurant, we're going out of the restaurant.
It's actually coming out and actually opening up. And you end up drawing attention to the aspects behind its making, like you're seeing all those parties that I mentioned. And it's weirdly this like weird combination of both very ironic and totally sincere, and it's also just a really catchy as hell number. I found myself humming it yesterday, actually, before the play that I'm currently in, before the curtain went up. It was like in my head and just, you know, kind of giving me the energy to begin. It really does capture the sense of beginning a performance, where the energy is really high. You're a little bit anxious. You're not quite sure how things are going to turn out. But it's funny because they repeat this, that the name of the song, May We Start, that ends up being repeated multiple times. And it just seems to mimic the sort of nervous energy you have before, you know, before you go out there, before the performance begins, you know, begins properly. There's a sense of fun and buoyancy, and there's also some really interesting lyrics in the song. One of my favorite little bits of the song is the authors are here, so let's not show disdain. The authors are here and they're a little vain. And that just gives you a little bit of an idea. It's like kind of both self-congratulatory and a little bit self-deprecating at the same time. There's a real like sense of fun and buoyancy to this that unfortunately I'm not sure the film itself ever really fulfills and doesn't even seem intent on fulfilling. But I do really like this opening number, a film I had many problems with, but just watching this beginning again, it really did stick with me. And I'd even say even if you don't want to watch the film, you could definitely watch this opening number. I think it's well worth it.
Well, Justin, I think this episode might be shorter than I thought it was going to be, because my favorite opening number of the year is also Annette's So May We Start. and I agree with literally everything that you said, so not much to add. I will say, I think that it really does, like, give you this promise for what the movie could be, and I kind of disagree. I think it is what the creators of the film want the movie to be. I think it also just didn't really work for me as a film. Unfortunately, I was very disappointed by not liking it, because some of my favorite people did like it, but I guess me and you are on that same page. But I do think that this is kind of what the vibe of the movie is trying to go for throughout, this kind of like, it's transgressive and it's self-aware and it's funny and it's irreverent, and that's everything that this opening sequence is doing. Like, you literally, as you said, get all of the people behind the film before they're in costume just making it. And I also just love the fact that it's not just like we're gonna start the show. It's not like the Muppet Show, you know, it's time to like the music or whatever, but it's literally them like asking permission to start the show, and in kind of a annoyed way, like, so may we start, right? Like, it's not even like may we start, like, they're not asking permission, they're asking permission in a bit of an aggrieved fashion. Like, they just like can't believe that this is like that, like, all they want to do is put on this show for us, and we're kind of keeping them from doing that in a way. And it's like a weird animosity in mixed into that joyousness around the creative process. And at a certain point, they're just all just like walking down a street together, and Marion Cotillard just seems like she's having the time of her life, and I wish there was a little bit more actual joy in the film itself. But I think it's great. When I watched that opening scene, I was like, okay, we are really in for something special. And then, I mean, I guess you could definitely call the rest of the movie special, but not necessarily good. So
I'm even more excited for when I see that movie tomorrow night.
it's an experience. I would not recommend it to most people, but I would recommend it to Noah, because I'd be very curious what he thinks. I would also be very curious what his wife thinks of it. So please let us know.
We'll definitely share.
In the meantime, obviously it's not going to be 3 for 3 because you haven't seen that one yet. So no, Noah, what is your favorite opening musical number?
I was a little bit torn. I want to throw out an honorable mention to 3090 from Tick Tick Boom, because on a purely musical level, it hits that musical aesthetic that I personally really like. And it was definitely one of my favorite individual songs from a movie this year. Also, it's very much the same vibes as Turning 30 from Bo Burnham's Inside. So it resonated with me on a deeply personal level. But I went for my pick in terms of a number that's not just a good song, but also, you know, you really uses the language of film to bring you into this musical world, you know, and this heightened reality. I went with the opening sequence for In the Heights. I'm very much a sucker for any movie that takes those sort of audio cues, which is something that Edgar Wright does a lot. And I think, and of course, with the musical, you have even more opportunity there to do that. And it uses the city of New York and just the landscape of New York and works it into the rhythm and tempo and melody of the song to bring you into the world and the story that In the Heights is going to tell you. It's very clear at this point that Lin-Manuel Miranda, especially whenever he's doing any hip hop infused music, he has a very, very, very particular style. And it's like the first note of In the Heights is like, yep, this is Miranda. And it works great in terms of setting the tone and the pace for the movie that follows. So that's my pick.
That's great. I'm really glad that someone picked that, because that was definitely my runner up. It just like, it's a moment where like the whole entire world feels like it's exploding with life and color and excitement. And
yeah,
and it really sets the tone for the joyousness.
Yeah, it's like a stomp the movie sequence. And just, I'm a sucker for any movie that like that goes for that sort of effect.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, now we're going to be moving into our favorite dance number. And I wanted to include this as a segment because I feel like most musicals have at least one really show-stopping dance number. A lot of times it is accompanied by songs, but sometimes it even isn't. You know, I'm thinking about like La La Land from a few years ago, where they have like a little bit of a musical interlude at the start, and then like the whole rest of that number is just singing when they're just like up there at the top of that mountain or hill or whatever. And I think that there's so much incredible dancing and skill that goes on in a lot of these like really huge numbers, and I wanted to give it some attention. So we'll start with you this time, Noah. What is your favorite dance number of the year?
Well, I did not go with any of the big ensemble dance numbers, impressive as so many of them are. On a personal level, I'm going to stick with In the Heights. I like the building side dancing sequence in When the Sun Goes Down. You know, if you're seeing this show on the stage, you're just going to see two people dancing around on the stage. But here they take what you can do with film and kind of play with that a bit. And you have this shift in perspective where they're dancing along the side of a brownstone in New York City. And you've got like you've got like this gloriously lit up sky behind them. And it's just it's a great way to visually enhance the effect. And I felt that the dancing really reflected the emotional power of the song as well. And that hit me on a more emotional level than some of, you know, the bigger, louder, more bombastic numbers, which are great. You know, stuff like, you know, to pull another example from In the Heights, stuff like 96,000, like those are great sequences. But this one, it was experiences like this one that just, they just stuck with me more. So that was my pick.
That's a great choice. It's interesting. I thought that sequence might pop up on this episode, but I was thinking that maybe for a different category. But it totally is a dance number at heart. So I think that that's a very interesting choice that I enjoy a lot. Justin, how about you? Did you go with an In the Heights number? There's so many incredible dance sequences in the Heights.
I did, and I'm recognizing now we are going to have a lot of overlap because I also went with When the Sun Goes Down. Yeah, this was, I agree with what you're saying, though. It's just, It's funny, when I was thinking about this category in relation to all the different movies from this year, I was like, you know, when I just hear dance number, I tend to think of like big group numbers. But then you realize, like, of course you can have just the two, you know, just the kind of two, you know, the two dance partners type thing, the Astaire Rogers, you know, that type of dynamic. And I just, this is really a number where I feel like the choreography is just doing so much work in terms of the characters and in terms of where they are at this point in the story. I really, when I was watching it again, I was just, I think the thing you recognize is how many times they come apart and how many times they come back together. And the fact that it is happening on the side of that brownstone in this impossible way, with the light that is really like so filtered and so like unreal in a way that makes it seem both that they are, you know, that maybe this dream of theirs is impossible. And at the same time, this need, like this power to perhaps transcend that. I think there's some really interesting tension there. And I was just really keyed into how the dancing works in that, and the sense of push and pull and of breaking apart and coming back together. And it's just a really interesting, and just a really interesting visual contrast to when they're in the in Nina's apartment and they're helping her pack as she's going back to school. And then it's just come out into this place that's just like glowing orange and feels like something that's, you know, out of a like a fantasia. It's just really, really stirring. But yeah, there's just, I just thought of this number because of how much work the choreography is doing in terms of advancing the story and the characters.
Yeah, no, I completely agree.
Yeah, that's interesting. I thought that if that was going to show up on the list, it would be under favorite romantic moments. And maybe it will.
Yep.
There's no rule against doubling up on selections, so there's still a chance.
We can double dip? Oh, yay.
Nice. Well, I mean, I prefer not to spread the love, because there was so much good stuff out there. But, you know, there was no rule against it. So I guess we'll see if that will happen later on. But yeah, I think that this is a really nice scene. I remember being very interested, like, into it in the theaters. I think I was just like, wow, that's great. I did not totally love the part where, like, the little boy sees them through the window and it's like, what? Yeah, it's nice. I'm gonna have to say it's not my favorite dance number, but In the Heights getting respect from all three of us, because I'm picking a different scene from In the Heights for my favorite dance number, and that's the club, which is this sequence that happens towards the middle of the movie.
Interesting.
Where Usnavi and Vanessa finally get to go on their date, and they go to this club. And it is just a tremendous, like, 4 minutes of cinema. I just love every minute of it. I rewatched it again last night in preparing for the episode, and it's just so great. It starts out with such a fun, nervous, flirty vibe as Usnavi is, like, trying to impress her and feeling very out of his element, because he just never takes the time to go to a place like this. He's always busy working and saving and doing all this stuff, and never takes the time to experience this sort of joy and sense of community on another level, right? He has this community all organized around his shop, but there's this whole other side to his neighborhood that he never gets to tap into. And I think that this sequence allows Vanessa to kind of explode his world with this whole other side of his city, as he says. And also, it just has this great kind of push-pull to it, where you know, he's trying so hard to impress Vanessa, and he ends up pushing her away throughout the sequence, for the very same reasons that he's trying to pull her closer. So from a narrative perspective, it feels very relatable and very powerful, and also just like, he just can't get out of his own way, and it's just so almost like cringy to see. But it's intermixed with this just tremendous dancing that, like, has to be over 100 dancers on stage just moving in sequence as Vanessa is roaming through the crowd and just like dancing with one guy and then another guy and getting passed about and so clearly in command of that space herself, and it has such a fun and exciting vibe to it that then like slowly turns as the date starts to turn, even as the energy never does. And it just, I think it's kind of incredible, and it ends on that great blackout moment, which then moves into a different sequence. But it's just, I thought it was fantastic, and it was the most impressed I have been of any dancing at all, like, in the entire year so far. So when I thought of this category, the very first thing that I thought of was the club, and I was never able to find anything that beat it, in my opinion.
Yeah, that scene has a wonderful kind of controlled chaos to it. There's just a real sense of danger and fun, and yet also the fact that you're never doubting that these people are incredibly skilled. Like, there's not a sense that this is ever going to be lost, that it's going to spiral out of control. It's really wonderful.
Yeah, I think I love that we all picked In the Heights for this category, though, because there's just so many incredible dance sequences that we didn't even talk about. You know, like the sequence that when they're all dancing together in the back alley. I'm forgetting what that one's
Carnival
called.
Oh, Carnival de Barrio?
Yes, yeah, yeah. Where they just, like, yeah. That was definitely a runner-up for me.
That's another great one, yeah.
Even the opening number is a great dance number. Noah, as you said, the pool number is really, it's incredible on its scope and scale. I think it looks not great technically sometimes. Like, they definitely did some green screening that didn't totally look as good as the rest of the film.
Yeah, that held it back from me, like, really considering it for this pick.
Yeah.
You know,
for me, I think just, like, Anthony Ramos and Melissa Barrera just, like, anchoring a sea of dancers dancing in unison, while also, as you said, giving that sort of, like, they almost, like, turn on and off the chaotic club energy of the scene in, like, a really interesting way. And yeah, I had no choice but to go with that pick. Now we're going to move on to our favorite musical moments of the year. And this is a very kind of, like, vague category, right? I mean, every musical has many, many musical moments. You could say almost every moment in a musical is a musical moment by one definition. So I'm really curious what you guys decided to go with here. Justin, let's start out with you. What was your favorite musical moment of the year?
Sure, yeah. And this is one of those things where it's like you can go really specific or you can go more broad. And I wanted to go very specific with this because I have a feeling this will not be the first time that this song is referenced in this episode. I'm going to go with one specific part. The very first verse of Come to Your Senses from Tick, Tick, Boom. And the thing that really, especially hearing it the first time, having never heard the song before, there's this really interesting, there's before the verse, there is a little bit of piano. But once it goes into the verse, all of a sudden the piano has sort of this really eerie kind of echo to it. And it doesn't last for the whole song. It's really only for the first verse. But the minute I heard it, I just, like, it just kind of floored me. Like, it's one of those moments that you just think is, okay, that's impossibly beautiful. How did someone come up with that? and the verse there, the lyrics there are, "You're on the air, I'm underground, signals fading, can't be found." And it's, I think, along with that sort of echoey piano, it gives you the sense of, from the beginning, this kind of sad acceptance of something that's been lost, like, even from the beginning. And I thought that was a really interesting way to begin a song. And it's especially important to the rest of the film because it's a song that is very much Jonathan Larson reckoning with his artistic life and his ambitions and how that butts up against the rest of his life, and specifically his love life. This whole sequence, of course, is rendered with both Vanessa Hudgens, who plays Caressa, who is singing the song as part of the workshop that his musical is undergoing, as well as Susan, played by Alexandra Shipp, who is his girlfriend. And it's a really just, there's something about the way having this as your foundation for the song. Because it goes from there, it builds from there, and it leaves this amazing emotional climax. But just the way the song begins in this place of, like, something that was beautiful but has now been lost. Like, it's already starting to fade from the very beginning. I just thought was, like, really inspired from a structural standpoint. And I just, you know, I think there's going to be a lot of talk about this song in general. But even if you can just picking out just individual moments of it, I think it's really worth it to see how it works and how it works sort of in total. So yeah, this was definitely the one for me.
Yeah, I love that pick because I think that something that's so interesting about that song is that it has to both serve the purpose of feeling like a song from a different musical, right? Because it's like a pivotal part of the movie that we're watching that he's creating a song for his musical, right? And so it has to feel like it's coming from this other thing, which is very different, like in terms of tone and setting and just like genre from the musical that we're actually watching. But it also has to feel like this climactic emotional moment for him in the musical that we're actually seeing. And it works beautifully, and it's just an incredible song on top of that. And it just, like, it feels like much of this film, in my opinion, just feels kind of like a magic trick. And you know, I think it's just great. And the two actresses just sing the hell out of it and sing it, like, seamlessly, right? Like, when it shifts from one to the other and back again, like, it just feels like they're in the same space doing this duet of a song that's not even a duet. So really, really amazing moment. I agree. Noah, what did you think was the best one?
So for me, we're going to stay inside Tick, Tick, Boom. I've been going back and forth on this one. And my runner-up is a song that I'm going to bring up later because I have to make sure we talk about it here. But for on a purely musical level, I'm going to go with the song, specifically the opening part of, I guess it's the second song in Tick, Tick, Boom, of Boho Days, where they've been having a party in Jonathan Larson's apartment, and, you know, his girlfriend and, you know, all these old friends, you know, most of which we understand are, you know, from the theater scene that, you know, he works in. And suddenly, and it feels like the way it happens is very natural. They all just start, like, slapping each other on the back or on chairs or on the walls to create this percussion effect. And then that leads into the song. And that moment for me just really captures a lot of the vibes of, you know, Justin, going back to our TCNJ days when we'd be, you know, up late somewhere on campus just hanging out with people. And, you know, the conversation would just spontaneously jump from topic to topic. And, you know, music would get up, people would start singing stuff. It very much captures that feeling of a very particular time and place in your life, you know, where you and your friends can just sort of be somewhere, you know, at all hours of the night, drinking, eating, you know, relaxing, and then spontaneously someone just throws on everyone's favorite song and everyone starts singing along. It's a very, very, there's a very powerful nostalgic pull for that type of scene for me. And that really drew me in. And I think just on a musical level, it was really well done. It was a great way to seamlessly, you know, have this normal scene with dialogue and, you know, characters walking around a room and having normal conversations, but then to still have, you know, bring a song into a way that doesn't feel like, okay, we're just going to stop, put the movie on pause, 'cause now we have to go over here and sing a song and then we'll start the movie again, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. And I have to tell you, Noah, this is my favorite musical moment of the year, too.
We're double because dipping all over the place.
Everything that you're saying is true. I love the spontaneity of it. Like, it really, like, they're singing a cappella. They're using, like, their hands and, like, just, the house.
It feels like a bunch of half-drunk and maybe a little bit high bunch of friends at 2 a.m. just sort of like, let's start singing a song, guys.
Yeah, and it's, like, it doesn't go on too long. Like, it really doesn't overstay its welcome. When I rewatched it again last night, I was, like, it really is just, like, barely 2 minutes. So it really feels like it could be this improvised, spontaneous thing. It just, except it's excellent, of course, but that kind of does a great little bit for, like, of character building for Jonathan Larson, too, because the movie really wants you to think that he is a musical genius, right, and that he maybe could be capable of just off the top of his head doing this thing, right? And I love the way that all of the people around him just compliment him, right? They're this one, like, singular creative community, and so they can just hop in and amplify and add to the song in all of the right ways, like, in just small moments, and there's just so much joy to it. And Andrew Garfield is just incredible in the scene. Like, he's just so in the moment in this, really, like, he sells the spontaneity of it so well. And I also really, really like this because I feel like they're a different type of musical would be tempted to use a sequence like this to show, like, this is why this great, like, group of community, like, of community of artists, like, are great, and they love what they're doing, and it's, like, a mission statement for the film, but, like, it also doesn't shy away from how, like, crappy their lives are, you know? Like, it doesn't, it, like, romanticizes it by not romanticizing it in a lot of ways, and that's just kind of a very subtle thing that I think is really hard to pull off, and it's just so great, and I've literally been, it's been in my head for, like, this 2.5 weeks since I saw it. I can't get it out. And I don't want it to. I want it to live there as long as I can. So yeah, that's definitely my favorite musical moment. Justin, did you consider this one since you were considering Tick Tick Booms?
I gotta be honest, no. I gotta say, as much as I do really love Come to Your Senses, I'm not a huge fan of Jonathan Larson's music in general, however, and I feel like this song is just, it's just a little too much for me. It's a little too earnest. It's just, it's not my style of music.
Boho, more like no-ho.
But I'm glad that both of you really liked it, so.
Yeah, that's, I can respect that. Now, I'm very curious about this next category, because this is one that, you know, I thought would be an easy thing to fill out, because so many musicals are just, they have this, like, great emotional center of romance, you know, and I feel like many of the best musicals of this year has that, but I found it to be kind of hard to find my favorite romantic moment. I think partly because I was thinking that I would see West Side Story before I made this list, and that very possibly one or more scenes from that film would be in contention, and I ultimately didn't get to see West Side Story. So I'm going to come back to me, but I'm curious, Justin, what did you pick for your favorite romantic moment of the year?
So this was actually, for me, it was a pretty easy one, because it's the one that I think, so not only the first time I saw it, but the second, when I was rewatching it yesterday, both times I felt a sob well up in my throat. It's from Apple TV Plus's Come From Away, which is, I have to say, even though it's not a film, I think it might have been my favorite musical of the year that I saw. It's a really wonderful, this probably won't be the first time it gets mentioned, but just this particular moment is, I guess you could say it's part of the number Stop the World, between these two passengers, these two, for those who don't know, Come From Away is about, these planes that were diverted to an airport in Newfoundland after 9/11. And they basically, the people there took them in and housed them and fed them and clothed them and did all that stuff. And, so these two airline passengers just met. They'd never met before. One was from the UK, the other was from Texas, and get to know each other. And there's this, like, really adorable kind of, I hesitate to say relationship, but this particular moment that I'm talking about is actually right before they're about to leave, where the airspace has been cleared. They're going to go back to their respective homes. And it's the two of them. The two passengers are Diane and Nick. And they're looking out over the Dover Fault. And the way this is depicted on stage is just with a bunch of wooden chairs that they're standing on. And somehow the actors create this magic trick where you really do believe they're looking out on this thing. And this feels like such a pivotal moment. The Dover Fault is actually a place where tectonic plates have smashed together and come apart again. It's the perfect setting for what may potentially happen here. And what has happened in the course of them, you know, this total accident of them ending up in this place in the first place. And the moment I'm thinking of is when they're both looking out on it, and Nick is clearly just totally enamored of Diane. He can't stop looking at her. And he has only two pictures left, like only two photos, because this is a time where, you know, you couldn't necessarily take a picture on a cell phone. He has this disposable camera. And he says, Diane's looking out on the Dover Fault, and he's looking at her, and he takes the camera, points it at the fault, then points it 45 degrees at Diane and takes a picture. there's just, it's so precious. And then the song that they sing, Stop the World, where the two of them are singing, but they don't. It's basically, you're basically hearing their internal thoughts, and they're both thinking very similar thoughts. They have very similar feelings for one another, but they haven't yet communicated it. And there's all, but through all that, there's this sense of an ending of how they think about how beautiful the time they spent together is, but how it probably won't last. Which, you know, not to spoilers, I guess, for Come From Away, but it does, because they end up moving in together later on. But at this moment in the musical, if you don't know that, you really don't know how things are going to end up. And it's just so heartfelt. I love the two performers in this. I think that they just are really, the emotion on their faces is so incredible to watch. And I don't know, you know, again, not to get too personal, I feel like I say that a lot in this podcast, but, you know, it hit home for me from a particular moment in my life this year, in a way that, just really hit me on such a gut level. And, yeah, I honestly, it's hard for me to think about without welling up. So I just had to go from this moment from Come From Away.
I love that choice. That's an excellent choice. The performers, by the way, Nick is played by Jim Walton, and Diane is played by Sharon Wheatley. And yeah, I will definitely be talking about this movie a little later in the episode, and I totally agree with everything that you said, how great that moment is. Noah, how about you? What was your favorite romantic moment of the year?
I'm going to be a little outside the box with this one.
Ooh.
So my pick is actually going to be from the movie Everybody's Talking About Jamie, which on the whole was fine. Like it was good. It was fine. I can't say that I loved the movie or the music, but it definitely had its moments. And one of them is going to come up later. And it's not a typically romantic moment. There's a scene where Jamie is just really feeling especially crushed by the circumstances that he finds himself in. So for what's the movie that came out a year or two ago with Meryl Streep and James Corden that was very loosely based on a true story of two of
those? The Prom.
Everyone's talking about Jamie is like the decent version of The Prom. Where it's based on a real life story of a gay kid who wanted to go to prom as a drag queen, and the school tried to push back against that, and it ended up becoming this whole thing. So this is a moment where Jamie is particularly beaten down, and his best friend, who I recall like they were friends since they were kids, is a Muslim girl from his class who also faces, you know, discrimination, and you know he gets teased and discriminated against because he's gay. And her, because she's a woman and Muslim, and that plays into her character arc as well. And there's a moment where she sings a song to him when he's really like just feeling down about everything, about how his name, the Arabic version of his name, means beautiful, and you know, singing about all these virtues and strengths that the name is associated with, and it's her, you know, lifting him up. And then at the end of the song, he says, you know, you're the best friend ever. You know, I have to go. And he has to, you know, leave and go back home. And he kisses. It's like, for him, it's a friendly platonic kiss in the cheek. But that's the moment where her face, like, makes you realize, oh, wait a minute. She's head over heels in love with him and knows that's literally never going to happen because he's gay. And just for that reason alone. But she's still in love with him. And that drives and influences so much of her character and how she interacts with him throughout the movie. I picked that because that was the one romantic moment out of any of the films that I was able to see for this that genuinely surprised me. When it happened, I was like, whoa, shit, I didn't see that coming. And then 2 seconds later, I started to think about it and was like, I probably should have seen that coming. What the hell's wrong with me? But it's not a typical romantic moment because it's not a moment that leads to, you know, two people actually coming together, you know, but it is a moment that is about one person's love for another and their struggles to understand and handle those feelings. And it was so, it wasn't overplayed. It was this really quiet, subtle moment, and it was very well done. It really, it was one of two moments in that movie that in a movie that was otherwise fine, that and one other moment were the two parts that really, really stood out for me.
I really like that. By the way, that that song that this moment happens at the end of was called It Means Beautiful. And the actress in question playing the part of Pretty Pasha is Lauren Patel, who I thought was really excellent in the film throughout. And I think that she's definitely playing that sort of like infatuation almost, you know, like she's not, it's not like a crush. It's more just like it's this amazing person in her life that she just can't help but love. And I agree. I think that there is a romantic undertone to it. But it doesn't, it, like the film, if you haven't seen it, doesn't really linger on that idea. It's not, she's not tortured by an unrequited love for him. She just loves him, and she loves him as a friend, and maybe she loves him as more than a friend, but she fully accepts him for who he is. So the idea of like wanting to be with him romantically really isn't there for her. It just is that like connection is so strong, and I think that really helps the audience too, because she's such a likable character, and sometimes Jamie isn't, and I think that having a person like that in his life really helps ground him. So I really like you highlighting that moment.
Yeah, I kind of wish we had a movie, a musical movie about her character. I'd watch the hell out of that, but
I think a criticism of the film is that maybe her character is a bit underdeveloped, but I think Lauren Patel does an excellent job trying to flesh her out as much as she can.
Yeah, and it's a, I like that you chose that moment too, Noah, because it's a reminder that romance doesn't necessarily have to be fulfilled to be romantic. You know, it's that sense of, it's that sense of, and it's almost the sense of impossible, you know, that I think is, that is, you know, it is very relatable. I really like that you, that definitely, yeah, that was definitely a moment for me too. I had a similar reaction where I was like, oh, but pretty wonderful.
Well, for me, I also went outside the box, but by box, I mean outside of the list of films that we were supposed to consider, because I couldn't help but choose a really incredibly romantic musical moment that it happens in a movie that's not a musical. And that's a movie that many people may have heard of called Belfast, a Kenneth Branagh film from earlier this year, getting a lot of attention from awards bodies. Was the TIFF Audience Award winner, has like an inside track for Oscar fame and glory. It's a movie that I thought was fine. I thought it was okay. I think that I'm not in the camp of this is an amazing film. I think you need to have a little bit more nostalgia in your heart to really, really love this film more than I do. But there is one moment that is just undeniable. And it's a sequence towards the end of the film where the father character, played by Jamie Dornan, is singing Everlasting Love to his wife at what is actually a funeral, or a party after a funeral, as the Irish do. His wife, played by Katrina Balfe. And he's singing this song in front of all these people, and she's just kind of standing there and like reacting to him and like playing along, and then they start dancing, and it's this just like incredible sort of from the perspective of their young son, who's like around 9 years old, which the whole film takes place in. It just is this incredible little moment of just romance and like larger than life, kind of like king and queen kind of like experience, where you're just like, these are my parents and they're beautiful and movie stars and in love, and everything is so like romantic about it. And it really is interesting contrast to a large portion of the film where there is an incredible amount of tension between these two people over the course of their family and what will happen with them and where they will live and what kind of life they want for their kids. And it's very rare in the film that you see a really strong sense of connection between these two, because they are going through so much stress and so much strife due to external factors and internal factors. And you get this little like grace note of a moment at the end of the film to remind the audience, to really inform the audience about what brings these people together. And it's just this incredible charisma, and it's this incredible this effortlessness to their connection that also it plays out in this amazing way, where it's like obviously on full display, it's in this public space, but the whole point of the film is that the public space feels like family. So it feels very intimate, even though it's happening in public. And it's just beautiful and amazing. And it maybe is too good for the film. It maybe kind of like undermines some of the other more interesting parts of the film because it's just such a show-stopping moment. But I think that it's great. And it was the most romantic thing I saw on screen this year, without a doubt, especially accompanied to music. And Jamie Dornan, a good singer and very charismatic, and Katrina Balfe just playing along and just showing her profound connection to her husband in that moment just really kind of broke my heart after seeing how much they were on the edge for a long part of the film. So it's my pick, Everlasting Love from Belfast, even though Belfast isn't a musical. I hope you guys will forgive me.
Oh, yeah. I mean,
that's what you meant by cheating.
Yeah, yes. I know. As you were thinking, I was like, oh, okay.
I was going to say, we could really stretch the boundaries and start bringing up Inside for some of these categories.
Because I probably would have given more consideration to Seagulls in the Sand, which Jamie Dornan also sings in Barb and Star Go to Vista Del Mar. But, you know, at least we got one Jamie Dornan musical number on here.
Yes, yeah, I did consider that one as well, but I felt like ultimately that wasn't nearly as romantic as this one because it was about unrequited love, and yeah. It was very, very funny, but maybe not the most romantic thing. But yeah, Jamie Dornan doing the most as a musical star in non-musical films, so you gotta respect that.
Yeah.
All right, now we're gonna move on into the acting portion of our show, and this is where we get to highlight some of the best performers and ensembles of the year in the world of musical films. And we're going to start out with a favorite ensemble. I think everyone is aware of what an ensemble is. We don't need to define the term like from the Oxford Dictionary, but I am very curious because all of the biggest films that we've seen from this year that are musicals have really large ensembles with just like a tremendous amount of moving parts. And I'm really curious, Noah, what did you think was the best one?
I'm going with In the Heights. And I'm saying this with the awareness of the fact that In the Heights did take a lot of heat, you know, not without reason, for being, for going much more light-skinned with its casting. But that's really not a discussion and a debate that I'm in any way qualified to comment on. So the fact of the matter is, I really liked the whole supporting cast they got for the movie. No one felt out of place. No one felt miscast. They all bring an incredible energy and personality to their roles. And they're all fun. I mean, all the numbers that involve, I mean, the lead roles are well cast and really, and do a great job of carrying the movie, but all the scenes focused on other characters are just as much fun and just as interesting because they all bring different stuff to their roles. It was straight up my favorite ensemble out of all the ones that I've seen.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to argue with. It's an incredibly talented group of people, and it's a group of people a mile long. So I definitely can understand that choice. Justin, how about you? What did you go with for favorite ensemble?
No, I did. I can't disagree with In the Heights. I mean, I agree. There's no one that's miscast in that film, but I had to go with Come From Away again. I love that these people all are so distinctive from one another. You're getting all different types of body types, ages, and just personalities in general. But I think even more than that, what this ensemble has to do is really incredible, just for the fact that you never really question it, which is that all these people are playing not only the people on the plane who are from all these different countries, but also the Newfoundlanders themselves. So they're switching characters and it's so seamless. You never stop to question it. And it actually makes it seem like it's a bigger cast than it really is. I just think they do an amazing job of just getting you to believe in this world and never questioning that these are different people. And also just, I just love that they all look like actual people. I feel like there's a certain, you expect a certain body type, especially when it comes to musicals and like big production musicals. You know, you have to be very fit to perform a lot of those kinds of numbers. And here it's like You've just got like different types of people, and everyone is just so crucial to making it all work. It all feels like this wonderful synergy that's happening. So yeah, just, man, this ensemble really, really blew my mind from performers that honestly, I didn't know any of them before this, and they just really won me over.
Yeah, I think that it's very easy to tell which is the Hollywood musical and which is the Broadway musical based on some of the things you're talking about. but yeah, I spoiler alert, I completely agree. This was my favorite ensemble of the year as well. And it's not even close. Like, it truly isn't even close because of what you're saying. Like, they are asked to do something that is just insane, in my opinion. I mean, I know that it's not uncommon in musical theater for actors to perform like multiple parts, right? Especially like you'll have like people like just jumping in to play like small parts while they're also playing one big part, right? That's not unusual. But if you haven't seen Come From Away, the way that this play or musical, I should say, is staged is there's basically a row of chairs, right? They're like about like three wide and like six deep or whatever, and it just kind of is on the center of the stage, and the center of the stage is rotating, and the actors are asked to just kind of like pick up the chairs, move them around every once in a while to reset the stage, and otherwise that's it. And they're all on the stage, all 12 of them are basically on the stage the entire film. Sometimes they're standing in the background when it's not their time to talk, sometimes they're all together. Sometimes they're shifting between multiple characters in a single sequence, especially like in the moments where they're playing multiple different characters on multiple different planes while also playing the Newfoundlanders. Like, and it just kind of like it moves so fast. And all of these actors have such a seamless command of all of the different characters that they're playing. And obviously, some of the characters are very fleshed out, and some of the characters are very, like, shaded in lightly. But still, they're just, like, shifting. They're just, like, taking hats on and off, putting clothes on and off, like, right in the middle of the stage, just, like, putting on a show in the most, like, earnest and exciting way possible. And they're just like nailing it. Like you said, it really feels like a magic trick. There's just so much momentum and so much dynamism. And it just like goes and goes and goes and goes. And it like shifts, and there's comedy and there's drama and there's like tension. And there's like all of this stuff happening. Obviously, it's an incredibly emotional time for the world and for these people in particular. And they're dealing with so much, and it's just like the full tapestry of human experience on display in 2 hours, and like they never stop. And I just think that it's incredible. I don't know how they did this. I just can't believe that everyone isn't talking about this all the time. And I really hope if you haven't seen it and you have any access to Apple TV Plus, watch it. If you could at all possibly safely see it in the theater, like actually a live performance, I think you would really, really benefit from it. And yeah, it's incredible. I just can't think of any ensemble asked to do more and that nails it as hard as these people do. And again, these people also, to me, totally unfamiliar with. I did not know any of them ahead of time. And yeah, they just were amazing. I can't speak more highly of this ensemble.
And so you're asking Alex about how they managed to pull that off, and to that I say, 'tis the magic of theater, my boy.
Truly, it is.
The theater!
And it's such a coherent ensemble that I genuinely couldn't possibly pick out, like, one or two performers to say, like, oh, this is the best performance, because it's just, they're all moving in unison in a way. Like, they're all moving, like, hand in glove, and it just works so effortlessly. It's just... it's an incredible experience that I hope everyone gets the chance to experience for themselves.
Yeah, just I'll add it to yet another thing on Apple TV Plus that I wish Noah had access to, because I know he would love it.
Oh, I'm very sure I would. One day.
Yeah.
Next time, Gadget, next time.
So now, typically, the way that awards are structured, we would talk about our favorite supporting actors first, and then move into favorite lead performers to close out the night. But I kind of decided to switch it up a bit because I feel like in musicals, oftentimes the true scene stealers are the supporting actors, and they're the kind of oftentimes tasked to be the heart and soul of a film. And so I wanted to save them for the end. So instead, we're going to move right into favorite lead performer of the year in a musical. And Justin, we're going to start with you. What was your favorite lead performer?
Yeah, so this was actually, I had a tough time with this one because I felt like a lot of the leads here were great in very different ways. But I had to go with someone that I feel like I've maybe talked about a lot on our previous episode of In the Heights. It's Anthony Ramos playing Usnavi. He's just so magnetic. He's so well attuned to the music in the show. He's adorably awkward when he needs to be. But I think just watching certain scenes from it yesterday, I think what really struck me was how well he sells all the dramatic shifts in his character. The moment when he sees that mural and recognizes that he's actually home before he even sings it, you just see it on his face. I think he has a ton of just a range of emotions to play in this. And I just think he nails it all the time. It's tempting. I mean, the first thing I tend to think of is just that amazing smile of his, which I'm sure could power several cities. But just really thinking about the performance in total, I think he has a lot that he is able to accomplish. And just always keeping you grounded. I mean, it's a show that is not necessarily doesn't maybe live or die on its lead performance, but when you have one as good as this, it only benefits. And so I just got to give some more love to my man Anthony.
Yeah, I mean, you know that I am head over heels in love with Anthony Ramos myself, so I fully support this choice. He's so magnetic in the role, and yeah, he should be a movie star, so hopefully that happens at some point, but I'm glad that he got this lead role in the meantime. Noah, how about you? What was your favorite lead performance of the year?
I'm going back to Tick, Tick, Boom, Boom. Tick, Tick, Boom. Wow. Tick, Tick, Boom.
Tick, 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 Boom, Boom, I think is like a popular dance number from like 2002.
Bada, bada, bing, bong. Okay. Where's my drum set and keyboardist? Anyway, I do not know nearly enough about the background of Jonathan Larson to say how accurate either his performance or the portrayal in the movie of Jonathan Larson is. But I get the character that they were trying to bring across. And I think Andrew Garfield just does an amazing job of carrying this energy of this, you know, incredibly passionate, energetic, flamboyant, and obviously very talented and creative guy who's also can be kind of a dick. And is maybe, you know, a little bit too, can maybe sometimes be a little bit too pretentious for his own good in some aspects, and who's also haunted by feelings of, shit, I'm getting older. Like, there's so many vibes from Bo Burnham's Inside that are also present in Tick, Tick, Boom. It's kind of uncanny that we got both of these movies in the same year. But Andrew Garfield brings it. I've gathered that there's some people who seem to just not like Andrew Garfield as a performer. I really like him. I generally really like the performances that he brings to most of his characters. I've not seen his Spider-Man movies and I don't care to, so I won't speak to that. But he delivers exactly the performance that the movie needs and wants from this character. And even I felt the movie might be a bit lionizing at points, but it doesn't shy away from aspects of his character that are very grating or self-destructive, you know? Like, you know, his power didn't have to be shut off the day before his performance. He could have just paid his bill. You know, he tries to insist on the phone that it's not his fault, but we've seen how many letters he's gotten. Hey, your power's going to get shut off. You need to deal with this. And he just ignores them. So that his performance incorporates that as well. So it's you've got this very raw personality in this performance that rawness can have both good and bad sides. And they're both present in the way he carries himself and acts and moves through the screen. But yeah, no, that's my pick.
Yeah. So I completely agree. He was my pick for this category as well. I can't believe how much overlap we've had this episode. But yeah, I mean, Tick, Tick, Boom is an incredible film, in my opinion, and I think it all is on the shoulders of Andrew Garfield. I think the film has a lot of good supporting characters, but, you know, as you've said, Jonathan Larson as a figure could easily be insufferable, and in other people's hands, I think he absolutely could have been, but Andrew Garfield
and
brings so much...
moments. He has moments where you're like, Jesus Christ, guy, stop shooting yourself in the face, you know?
Like, right, which I think is perfect. I think that's so important for the film that it's not a hagiography of him. It shows him with his rough edges. But Andrew Garfield's performance of those rough edges really just like brings so much empathy to him and like brings the audience into his perspective and like dares you to care about him even when you're rolling your eyes at him. And I think it's in large part because he just has this like deft, like light touch to so many of the scenes that he has. And there's just so much joy that he brings. I keep bringing back to this point of joy. Like, I think so many of the best films that were musicals this year really center on joy, joy through tragedy, joy through, through adversity. And this film is definitely about that in a lot of ways, but it could have been insufferable, right? It's this guy who just is like, I'm the greatest person who ever was, but no one actually believes it because all of the stuff I've done is apparently bad, but who cares? I know that I'm a genius and everyone should worship me, basically. But that's a really tough character to make you care about. And Andrew Garfield does, and he does it like with spades. You know, I just like think about the sequence where his friend is moving into the expensive apartment uptown and he's like singing and dancing and he's like a Muppet in that sequence, truly. Just like all arms and legs and smiles on his faces. And then he just has these like other moments where it's like so serious and emotional, like when he finds out that same friend is, you know, he gets that, I don't want to spoil it, but his friend gets some bad news and he kind of has to reckon with that. I think that the small moments, the big moments, every moment that he's on screen works for me, and it really helps make what could have been obnoxious or annoying or grating or like, really, guy, you're really gonna do this? Like, so many moments, like, he just papers over by just being so winning. And I just absolutely love him in this film, and I think the film would not work without his performance. So 100% Andrew Garfield, favorite lead performer of the year in a movie musical. But now we're moving into favorite supporting performers, and this I can't imagine will have overlap because there's just so many choices, so many options out there to choose from, especially thanks to such wonderful ensembles that we can pull and highlight individual people from. So Justin, who was your favorite supporting performer of the year?
Well, of course, I have to go with James Corden in Cinderella. How could you not? That screaming head on a mouse body.
Well, good night, everybody. That's all, folks.
No, of course not. I don't know what your pick is yet, Alex, although I happen to know, just based on your letterbox, that you're a big fan of this performance. So hopefully, we'll see if this is an overlap. But I actually went with Sarah Lancashire in Everybody's Talking About Jamie. This is, in this movie, she plays Jamie's mom. You get the sense that she has always supported him, even to the point where he actually recognizes in the course of this film that he's maybe in some aspects taking it for granted to a certain extent. But she really is like a real emotional rock in this film. And the moments when you need the kind of unconditional love from a character, she gives you those moments. But at the same time, I think it's even more complicated than that, because she is, her character does end up lying to Jamie, you know, as a way to protect him, as a way to make him, you know, believe that his dad actually cares about him still, which he, you know, has basically moved on at this point because he's a just total douchebag. But this, those moments,
he deserves,
especially
his fate at the hands of the witch.
Those moments, and there's one particular song, He's My Boy, which she sings completely alone, is just a really beautiful moment of recognizing what her son means to her, but recognizing like all the challenges that it's brought to her as well, and how all those challenges have been worth it because of who he is. especially the way that she deals with Jamie once he has been physically assaulted, which is one of the more difficult parts of this movie. Like, she's just so steadfast. And it's almost like when she's talking to him, it's like the things that she's saying to him are things that she's always felt. You don't get the sense that she's only recognizing him now. These have been with her for a long time. There's a wonderful exchange where Jamie says to her, "Mom, do you ever wish I were normal?" And she just looks at him with this, you know, this dead glare and says, "No, never." Man, that's just what you need at that moment. And I think she's dealing with a lot of different, like, she's not a perfect character. She makes a mistake, maybe with good intentions, but ultimately I think that ends up backfiring. But at the same time, she's completely raw and open and exactly what you wish everyone would have in their life. But you know, it's just a really wonderful performance. And she's, again, not an actress that I was really familiar with. I was actually looking at her credits. I'm like, I have to have seen her in something, right? And I just could not find anything. But yeah, just really, really just floored me, honestly.
Yeah, I think she's incredible in the film. I actually didn't go with her. I went with a different performer from the same film, though. And that is Richard E. Grant, who plays Hugo Battersby. Nice. This is like, in
God
some
damn
ways,
it,
this
Alex. God damn it.
This character is.
We weren't going to double dip.
Well, so in some ways, this character is like a terrible cliche, right? Like the kind of like fairy godmother, like. Queer character who's there to like help the younger character self-actualize, right? But I think that like the way that the film handles that is just great. I think that like it really ties the connection that Hugo has with Jamie into this kind of yearning for a community and for history, which is something that needs to be passed on from mentor to mentee and in the queer community, because you don't have that same sort of inherited family. You need to seek that family outside of your family and learn from their experiences. And I think that the film handles that very well. A criticism that I've seen of the film is that many of the songs are very maudlin and overwrought. And I totally hear that. And I don't think that's necessarily even wrong. But I think that Richard E. Grant's like singular number where he's kind of singing about like what it was like back in the good old days. It is just like, I don't know, it is totally maudlin and it is overwrought and it still made me cry. And I think that's because Richard E. Grant just delivers the hell out of it and is just so great. And I think like Richard E. Grant was born to play a drag queen, and I just love that he got the opportunity to do it finally. And I think he's just great in every second of this. And I think he elevates the character so much beyond what is written on the page. And I think that the best performers do that, right? Like some performances are great because they have an incredible opportunity and they make the most of it. And some performers are great because they don't have a great opportunity and they elevate it considerably. And I think that's kind of what Richard E. Grant was dealing with here. And I'm really, I just, it's the thing that I think about most now, having watched the film over a month ago. So I couldn't help but give it some
that
love.
That song of his. Yeah, that song of his is the song that I wanted to bring up at some point in this call. This Was Me. I think, for all the other criticisms that I have for everyone's talking about Jamie, and for the fact that it's not anywhere close to my being one of my favorite films of the year, that sequence is one of the best sequences I've ever seen that takes a song or a musical number and incorporates it with a wholly unique visual aesthetic, you know, taking you into the world of late 80s, early 90s home videos. So taking a song, a musical set, and doing something that you really can only do with film. Like that's not possible in any other medium. And doing it so seamlessly while still having this like Ghost of Christmas Past effect where the modern day characters are popping in and out of these, you know, flashbacks to the struggles for LGBTQ rights in the 1980s. And they feel like ghosts that are just sort of dropping in there and observing these characters fighting and struggling and loving and laughing and dying. And it is the highlight of the film. And it's one of the best individual sequences in any film that I've seen this year.
So, Noah, are you saying that this was your favorite supporting performance as well?
Okay, my picture was a tie between this. Ah. We've already talked about Richard Grant, so I'm going to talk about Lauren Patel as Pretty Pasha.
Wow. That was my second. Wow, we all went with Jamie. Wow.
Yes. Alex insisted we weren't going to double dip, but he was very close to being wrong. I talked about a little bit about her character before into romantic moments. She and Richard Grant are very much the highlights of the movie for me, and pretty much all of their scenes work, scenes and or musical numbers work really, really well. And the movie would, like, the movie would only have been better if they had even more screen time in it. Yeah, there's not much more I can say to her because we already talked about her at length under the romantic scene bit, but it's a great performance and a great character. I found it rather amusing. It was a combination of her voice and just the way, like, the types of expressions that she used. At times she sounded like an 80-year-old grandma. I was like, you're a high school student. Why does it sound like my grandmother's just popped out of the grave and fused into one personality?
Oh, wow.
But in an adorable sense, like in a sweet and adorable sense.
In a SpongeBob chocolate grandma sense.
Yes. Now let's finish so I can go eat more chocolate. This is Cinema Joe's trial.
I can't say I felt that way about her performance, but I did enjoy it very thoroughly, and I do think she's really great. I think one of the biggest, as I said already, one of the biggest criticisms of the film for me is that she doesn't get more to do and she doesn't get fleshed out more. I really thought that we were headed for a subplot around her character at some point, and we just, like, never get it, and I think that that is to the film's detriment. But the reason why I felt that way in large part was because of how great Lauren Patel is in the role. So, you know, fully support this choice. I have to say, though, I did not peg that everybody's talking about Jamie was going to go 3 for 3 in supporting. That is a very big surprise for me. And I think it's also just, like, for a minute of self, like, navel gazing, super interesting that despite the fact that we did not talk about this at all, we really tried not to talk about any of the films in contention amongst ourselves ahead of this episode. We were really in sync, pretty much. So, like, every category, at least two of us agreed, and except for two categories where we all picked different things from the same movie. So we definitely have similar taste, if you guys didn't realize. But speaking of similar taste, I didn't prepare you guys for this, but I just think while we have a couple minutes left at the end, you guys could briefly tell me, like, what is maybe your favorite musical film of the year, and what is your least favorite of the ones that you've seen? Noah, let's go with you first.
I'm having a hard time picking between In the Heights and Tick, Tick, Boom. I'm probably going to have to go on balance. I'm probably going to go with In the Heights.
As your favorite, right?
As my favorite.
And what about your least favorite?
I haven't technically seen Dear Evan Hansen, but I've seen 4 hours worth of YouTube deep dives into the failures of the movie. And it sounds like something that I would absolutely despise if I were to actually sit down to watch it. I don't want to say everybody's talking about Jamie because I felt it was fine but not great, but it's not bad. I do not want to shit on that movie as, like, a movie that's not worth seeing, because it definitely is.
Yeah, totally. It's just not maybe as...
So much better than The Prom. Don't see that's my pick, The Prom. Don't see The Prom.
The Prom is so bad it gets it 2 years in a row, basically. Justin, how about you? What was your favorite and least favorite of the year?
So if we're going with, like, you know, all including the staged the filmed performances as well as the movies, I have to go with Come From Away as my favorite. It just I'd heard the music before, like, one other time. I have a friend who actually someone who's been a guest on this podcast, Joanna Johnson, she actually, like, tried to educate me on more musical theater at my request, and this was one of the musicals she had recommended. So I recognized some of the music, but seeing it was a totally new experience for me. There's only so much that your imagination can do. I didn't know about the rotating stage, and that was really wonderful. I loved how much they did with so little and how convincing it all was, to the point where, like I said, you don't even question it. And I know there were plans to adapt this as a film, and having seen the production, I'm kind of like, please don't.
they decided not to. It's actually like, it was in development for a long time, and they ultimately decided to do a documentary about the, like, what happened and everything, and then record this as a stage play instead. And I'm so glad that they did, because truly, like, how could you possibly do this as a film? Like, it would just completely diminish what is so special about it.
Yeah. And I will say, I know we talked a lot about, and there's been a lot of talk about how it's a, you know, it's about the hope of humanity, like, in the face of adversity. And that's certainly a big part of it. But I don't think the musical shies away from the less savory aspects of this. We see a lot of the sort of burgeoning Islamophobia that would come in the wake of 9/11, with one character in particular. And even as they return to their lives, there's this sense of melancholy that starts to settle over as things start to, you know, I guess, kind of get back to normal, but also you get the sense that they never will be normal again. So I do want to say that it is not just it's not just about making you feel happy because of this tragedy that happened. I feel like that was maybe how it was sold. I think it's a little more complex than that. And I will say, for my least favorite, again, I will go with a filmed production. And that was, I had the displeasure of seeing Diana the Musical. I will say, is it the worst thing I've ever seen? It's really not. Don't expect some kind of, like, this is not a musical on the level of The Room or something like that. This, but it is, I think it just, especially having seen Come From Away before this, it was just amazing to me to see the contrast. The lyrics especially are incredibly egregious, to the point where I'm like, how did these get approved? How was this okay? And I recognize that, yes, this, like many other musicals, this was a workshopped musical. It changed, but still, when that's what your product is, I think at a certain point you have to say, no, this is unacceptable. However, you have the Diana name associated with it, which I think gives it more of a pass. I will just spotlight this, which I think some people have. One of the lyrics in this musical is, when Prince William has been born, and Charles, as he's holding his son in his arms, sings this line, "Darling, I'm holding our son, so let me say, jolly well done."
Oh my god.
Oh
yes.
Oh no.
This was a Broadway musical. Bring
out the Takei voice. Oh no. Oh my.
Was it done with at least like a little bit of like a tongue in cheek sort of like
tone? No, and that's actually a big problem with this. This is like tonally all over the place. There's times where it's like verging into camp, but then doesn't quite get there. And that's like, I think parts of it might be fun for a hate watch if you're into that kind of thing. But I would say it doesn't quite go far enough. So there's gonna be
I hate the British monarchy, but not that much. I'll stick with the crown. Thank you very much.
And also, just I have to say, this was also a case, again, having seen Come From Away before, you really do feel like a lot of the main performers are just either like fine, or some of them are just not good. I'm not going to even say his name, but the actor who plays Prince Charles, I thought was incredibly bland, and I really can't believe they couldn't get anyone better than that. But, you know, when
the obvious joke is to say, because he's playing Prince Charles.
I don't know what kind of outfit you have anyway, but yeah, this was, this is real bad. And I know like there's been a lot of hyperbole about it. I think some of it maybe is a little unmerited. At the same time, really proceed with caution if you're going to watch this.
Yeah, I fully intended to watch this for the episode, just because I'm a completist. But I had watched two very disappointing musicals in a row, and this was next up. And I just got 5 minutes in, and I was like, I just literally can't do this to myself. Like, my life is worth more than this. And so I stopped watching it. So I'm glad that you did, so it could be represented on this episode for posterity's sake. For me, my favorite musical of the year is Tick, Tick, Boom. It's maybe my favorite film of the year. We'll see. There's still a number of high-profile films that I haven't seen yet. Okay. But right now, it is number one.
Interesting.
I just fell head over heels for this thing. I think that it is just so beautiful and so fun and so moving and so inside my head about just kind of like, you know, aging and like what you want to give to the world and just like and the incredible story of Jonathan Larson and the incredibly upsetting truth of the fact that this is a man who felt like he had was a once in a generation talent whose work could change the world and who was running out of time to give it to the world, and it turned out in every single sense he was correct. And that's just kind of an incredibly moving and upsetting story, and the way that it's told here is so beautiful and vibrant and told in the spirit of the person who he was in every sense of the way. And I love the fact that it shows you who he is, warts and all. It isn't this sort of like, look at this like fallen angel on the horizon that we've all grown up loving and worshiping, right? Like, it really does show why like maybe all of his friends hated him but like loved him despite himself, you know. And yeah, it's just the music is so great, the sequences are excellent, it's so funny, which I feel like people aren't talking enough about, like the Sunday diner scene, like many people have highlighted that as being a bit eye-rolly, and I just feel like that is presented in a very funny, humorous way. Like, the self-importance of that sequence is done fully, like, tongue-in-cheek, and I just don't think everyone is picking up on that, but I really liked that part of it.
It's the type of camp you definitely have to be on board for. If you hate that sort of thing, you're gonna hate it.
And it just, like, again, just, like, felt relatable. Like, I've certainly, like worked at a job like that, and to pass the time, imagined that a vibrant musical number was happening. So maybe this just hit really close to home. And I will say, I've never seen Rent, so I have no personal fondness for Rent at all. That's not influencing me and my experience of the film. But I just loved it, and I loved Andrew Garfield. I loved the supporting cast. Alexandra Shipp really surprised me by how excellent she was. She was a real runner-up for me in terms of favorite supporting. I think that the character didn't always have as much to do to like really warrant that title, but I think that she was really excellent in the role. I had no idea she could sing so great. I didn't know that Andrew Garfield could sing so great, although I'm not surprised because he gives like peak theater kid energy, which is just perfect for this. So yeah, this is like truly the fall of Andrew Garfield. He's doing great work. He's in lots of things. I rewatched his amazing Spider-Man films to prepare for No Way Home, and he is genuinely very good in those, and him and Emma Stone in those movies are just like, it's like a crime to cinema that they were so adorable and so charismatic and had such electric chemistry and were in those movies. But that is beside the point. I'm in like a big Andrew Garfield moment right now, and I love Tick, Tick, Boom. A movie that I did not love there were two that I was really choosing between. I really wanted to go with Dear Evan Hansen because I think it's a genuinely offensive film and like maybe dangerous film. It really kind of in a way that I just truly can't wrap my head around, like genuinely sends the message that if you kill yourself, everyone else's life will be better at the end of the day. And I just think that that's insane. And I really wish that they hadn't made this into anything. Unfortunately, despite that truly awful thing that I just said, there was something that was worse, and that was Kay Cannon's Cinderella, which is available on Amazon Prime right now. It is truly one of the worst things I've ever seen. It is so incredibly bad, I think. It takes the story of Cinderella and says, like, but what if she was also a girl boss? And I just think that, like, it really truly doesn't understand the story of Cinderella at all. I have no personal affection for the story of Cinderella, but, like, the idea that they're, like, the climax of the movie hinges on, like, well, what if, like, she can have it all? She can have a career and a man. It's, like, that's not what Cinderella is about. Like, what are you guys doing? Like, and it also feels like it should have been made 15 years ago on top of that. So it just... And like the musical numbers, it's like a jukebox musical, and those should be fun. And instead, it just feels like they're just like vampires trying to like latch onto and like drain the energy of those songs out of themselves to like support the film. And it's just terrible. It's just terrible from top to bottom. It exists in this like bizarre world where it's like maybe it's like the Renaissance and maybe it's like 1987, and I don't know. And I just like think it's just a disaster from top to bottom. Like every single creative choice was bad, like truly every single one. It's very rare that I've experienced such a total catastrophic failure on all levels. And I really went into it with the bet, like, I had heard that it was not very good, but I really like Kay Cannon. I really like Blockers. I like the work that she's done. And I really was like, well, maybe I'll like it more than them. And no, I just don't know, like, what the hell happened, but I hope we can all collectively forget about it, so the people involved yeah. can, like, go on and live a nice life.
Yeah, no, that's another, like with the Diana musical, I caught a snippet of one of Billy Porter's scenes on Twitter, and I was like, ooh, not going to watch that. That's, that goes on the never list.
Yeah, never.
The never, never land, the never, never watch land list.
Yes, absolutely. Just please do, and honestly, if you're like, wow, that sounds like a true disaster, I can't wait to see it, like, don't. It's also incredibly boring. It's not interesting yeah. as a, it's not a fun bad movie in any way either.
It's honestly, it's like, unlike, I'd say it's not maybe as bad as Diana the musical for me, but it was maybe the most depressing because of the people involved. Because of Kay Cannon's involvement, because of some of the actors like Idina Menzel and Minnie Driver, who I haven't seen for a while. I'm like, oh, I'm glad she's working, but in this? Oh, no. Like, just really just made me think, like, I really hope to see these people bounce back from this. And I have confidence they will.
Yeah, and they filmed most of this movie, like, I believe in the fall of 2020, so they were like literally risking their lives to put this film together, and it just is just baffling to me.
Was it worth it, James Corden? Was it worth it?
I mean,
never know.
Multiple reasons why that is not the case.
Yes. So yeah, that's definitely gonna take the cake for worst thing that I saw this year, I think, probably. You know, that's the year in musicals, guys. We did it. I'm very proud of us. We got through 8 categories in under 90 minutes. So props to
this
us.
This has been the Cinema Joe's response to the Tonys, the Joeys, if you will.
Well, let's not get them, that community, angry with us. But in the meantime, if you've enjoyed this conversation about musicals and movies and all sorts of things, and you've enjoyed hearing from us, let's now turn to where you could hear us in other places. Hear us, read us, see us. Justin, how about you? Where can we see more of your stuff out there in the world?
Yeah, so I have a website, which is thecinemaverick.com. I am also on Letterboxd at Cinemaverick. Also, if you want to hear us talk about more musical moments, you can listen to Pod on the Rooftops, which is a podcast dedicated to the rock band Genesis. Noah and I, as well as Luke Martin of the Talking the Coda podcast, talk about Genesis, talk about all their albums, and go through different categories, not unlike this episode. And the best place for you to find that would be on thepopbreak.com.
Excellent. Noah, how about you?
Well, I'm going to double or second what Justin said about Pod on the Rooftops. You should definitely go check out our work on that. It was a lot of fun to put together. And for me, you can also check out my written reviews and other collection of cultural musings at my blog at francenoir.blogspot.com.
Great. As for me, you can follow me on Twitter and Letterboxd at Media Thinkings. You can follow my work as the podcast editor for popbreak.com by going to thepopbreak.com and clicking on the podcast tab. You'll see all the new podcasts that we've been working on over there. You could subscribe to those podcasts by subscribing to Popbreak TV, which features a weekly and monthly series all about television, TV news, nerdy content, reality shows, dramas, histories, all sorts of things over there. You could also subscribe to The Breakcast, which features wrestling and music and movies and so much more. You can also check out my recent appearance on the popbreak.com's socially distanced podcast, where I talk about the penultimate episode of Hawkeye, which was a lot of fun with the host of that show, Bill Podkin. In addition to my podcast work on Pop Break, I will be releasing by the end of the year a list of my favorite comic book TV adaptations over there, the top 15. I watched 19, so 4 didn't make the cut. But yeah, 15 overall. It was a really rich and exciting time for comic book adaptations. Lots of, you know, superheroes, but also more interesting stuff, like, or not necessarily more interesting stuff, but not capes and cowls, like Why the Last Man and Sweet Tooth. And yeah, you can check out all of my thoughts on that by the end of the year. I'm not sure exactly when that post is going to be going up, but definitely by the end of the year. As for our show, you can follow Cinema Joes at Cinema Joes on Twitter. You can keep a list of all of the movies that we do featured reviews on by checking my list over on Letterboxd at Media Thinkings. And also, yeah, you can subscribe to us on Anchor and Spotify and Apple Podcasts and all of the major podcast platforms. So without further ado, this has been Alex, and we will see you next time, where we will be reviewing the biggest cinematic event of the year, apparently, which is Spider-Man No Way Home. So keep a lookout for that.